days in Thomas's life have been rather difficult. They've probably been the worst days of his life. And it's not really an exaggeration to say that his world in this moment has fallen apart. So for 3 years of his life, he had been on a trajectory. It was a trajectory established by a set of assumptions about how the world works and what God was up to and who this person, Jesus of Nazareth, actually was. He was a prophet. He was a teacher. He was a healer with divine power. He was the hope of Israel. He was a light shining in the darkness, a sign of God that the Lord remembered his people and was moving to rescue them from evil. He was the Son sent from the Father, the Messiah, the Lord, the King. He was Thomas's friend. The lamb who was to take away the sins of the world was taken away by the sins of the world. So his assumptions had been wrong, apparently, because Jesus was dead and Thomas had been a fool. But if Thomas was a fool, at least he was a fool in good company. Because while Thomas has had a hard time not getting the events of the past few days out of his mind, apparently the trauma of everything that had happened had compromised the sanity of his friends. Because his friends keep telling him, "We have seen the Lord." "No," Thomas wants to say. "We saw him. We saw him die." "Well, he's been raised to life," they say. "No. No, he hasn't. And don't tell me that he has. Don't rope me into your weird delusion. Don't tell me that you have had some powerful spiritual experience and you have felt his presence and you believe that he is now with us. Don't spin this into a myth, a story, a wish, a platitude that is supposed to somehow negate everything that we have been through." "No," he says, "unless I see the nail marks in his hands, put my finger where the nails were, and put my hand in his side, I will not believe. I will not believe." So history has noted Thomas's refusal to believe in the resurrection, and it's given him an unfortunate reputation for it, which is a little bit sad because if you know anything about the church tradition, the writings after the Bible that kind of fill in what happens to all of these people, you'll know that Thomas becomes a great missionary. From the resurrection, he begins to evangelize in the East. And tradition has it that he made it all the way and planted churches on the western coast of India. There's a lot to remember Thomas for, but no, all he gets stuck with is this moment. And so he's known as the apostle who doubted, the one who didn't believe. He's the skeptic. He's doubting Thomas. Doubting Thomas. His name has now become a metaphor for skeptics. And I'm not really sure he's earned the reputation. Yeah, he didn't believe, but he's not the only one. All four Gospels tell us that the first people to discover the empty tomb were his female disciples. And Luke tells us that the women went directly to the apostles and told them that Christ had been raised from the dead. It was the women, by the way, who were the first proclaimers of the resurrection. And Luke says, but they, the 11 apostles there, did not believe the women, because their words seemed like nonsense. And then Peter gets up and he runs to the tomb and he discovers it's empty and he says Luke says that he went away wondering to himself what had happened. Wondering to himself what had happened. They had told him what had happened, but Peter didn't believe them. John says the women came and they told all the male disciples, but then later that day, instead of rejoicing, instead of celebrating, instead of hoping, they have locked themselves into a room because they were afraid. Christ appears to them, and the first thing that he does is he shows them his hands and his side. Now, Thomas wasn't there. And what Thomas says that he needs is nothing more than the exact experience that everybody else has had. So, confusion and doubt and needing more information, needing an experience that confirms the truth of what people are saying about Jesus. All of this has been part of the church since the very beginning, right? So if your journey ever takes like a weird curve and all of a sudden you have questions and you're not really sure how the pieces all now fit together, well, you're in good company. You're in the company of the apostles themselves. But Thomas's struggle is a bit unique, I think. I think it's more than just skepticism. Listen again to what he says he needs. Unless I see the nail marks in his hands, I put my finger where the nails were, I put my hand in his side, I will not believe. See, Thomas knows that his friend Jesus was crucified. And he is not going to accept someone's testimony, someone's answer, that, let's face it, sounds a little bit easy. Jesus is alive. Well, okay, but that sounds a little bit like maybe one of those spiritual platitudes that some people grab onto and find comfort in, but don't always ring true. And so if by some miracle, what his friends are talking about is actually something that really happened, if they saw Jesus in some way, Thomas needs not only to touch him to make sure that he is real and physical, but he also needs to see and touch the wounds themselves, because that will be evidence that this person who has been resurrected is the same person that went to the cross. For Thomas, the resurrection can make sense of the cross. It can vindicate it. It can show us how Jesus' crucifixion was actually part of God's plan, that through the crucifixion we would have atonement. It would be the inauguration of the kingdom. The resurrection can help us understand what happened in the crucifixion. But Thomas is not going to let the resurrection in any way negate the crucifixion, in any way make it less horrible, in any way change what he knows he experienced. And because of this, I can't help but think of Thomas's doubt as a kind of faith. It's at least a faithfulness to reality. Thomas has made a decision that he is going to live in the real world. He's going to trust the data. He's not going to sacrifice what he can see with his own eyes for the sake of believing what somebody else has said. And so Thomas's doubt, I think, is a doubt, an experience that many of us have undergone once or twice in our lives. So we grow up. I grew up with a worldview and a vision of God that had been predicated on certain core beliefs. A lot of us grew up in church. And so we were taught by amazing teachers and amazing parents and amazing mentors the basic truths of Christianity. And yeah, they were a little bit simplistic as we learned them. They were appropriate for our little kid minds. But we latched onto them, and we believed them with certainty, and we believed them without a shadow of a doubt. And then life has this way of just imposing itself on us. And we can undergo trials and experiences that are not only difficult, but may reveal that some of those core beliefs we had were a little naive. And then we find ourselves in the middle of a faith crisis. We have questions. We have doubts. And the doubts and the questions, they can spur us to curiosity. They can spur us to seeking out answers that can lead us into a deeper and more mature experience of God. In fact, those little moments of doubt and questioning can become some of the most important moments of your spiritual journey as they lead us deeper into understanding who God is. But it can also be a really difficult process. If you've ever been just in the middle of that, where you're not really sure how the pieces fit together, how what you learned when you were a child now fits the world as you see it, you know that that can be a hard process. And unfortunately, sometimes people don't find the church to be altogether that receptive to people's questioning. I hope that's not the case here. I do know from my friends and from our own experiences that that process can be a little bit lonely. So Thomas follows Jesus. He's got this understanding of how God is working through Jesus. And then Jesus dies. And all of what he thought, all of what he believed, just falls apart. And Thomas has to wait a whole week, a whole excruciatingly long week before he finally starts to get an answer. Okay, Tiffany, my wife, had to wait a little bit longer than a week. So I was writing and working on this sermon. I love this story. And we were talking about it. I said, hey, I kind of need some help. I want to bounce some ideas off you. So we went for a walk. And she reminded me of some of her own experiences that resonate with Thomas. And she encouraged me, allowed me to share them with you. So the first thing you need to know about Tiffany is that she's got great parents, amazing parents. And I'm not just saying that because they're right here. Mostly not just saying that because they're right here. Tiffany's parents cultivated in her and her brother both just a deep love for God. She loved to go to church. She loved the youth group. She loved participating in worship. She loved LTC. She grew up with that, and she loved it. But most importantly, she loved God. And she experienced intimacy, a relationship with God. In college, Tiffany was the one who felt called to give at least some portion of her life to the kingdom. So she was the engine that spurred the both of us to work as apprentice missionaries in Germany. So we lived in Germany for a couple of years. And at the end of our time in Germany, we hit this season where all of a sudden we were going through all these changes at once. We became parents for the first time, and then just a few weeks later, we moved from Germany back to the United States. It's a stressful transition there. I didn't really have a job at the time, so we moved into my parents, which was okay. I'm grateful for them. Mom, who's right here. I decided to go to graduate school to become a minister. So we moved to Abilene. And while we were in Abilene, we started just having to deal with a bunch of stuff. I was going to school. That was a new experience. We had some family drama that was starting up. Tiff and I, we were having some things in our marriage that we were having to work really hard at. And in all of this, Tiffany began to notice something about her prayers. It had probably been like this for a while, but she hadn't been aware of it until this moment in Abilene when it occurred to her that God felt very, very distant. The experience of intimacy that she had when she was younger was not there anymore. And it was hard for her not to feel, maybe wonder, if the reason the feeling wasn't there was because God was not there. So Tiffany saw this as a problem, and Tiffany is a problem solver. So she immediately threw herself into intensive Bible study. She signed up for women's classes and worship groups. She committed herself to prayer. She even set up a prayer closet in our home. Now, we lived in a two-bedroom duplex. We did not really have closet space for her to create a prayer closet, but she did anyway. She was trying to fix it. And I felt scared. I felt inadequate. I mean, I was going to graduate school to become a minister, and Tiffany's asking me questions, and I'm not giving her any answers that seem to be satisfactory. And I remember one night just being angry at God, and I prayed. I prayed to him, God, she believes in you. So just give her something. She's asking for you to draw near. Why won't you do that? Why are you so distant? And then I'm going to let Tiffany explain the moment when something shifted just a little bit. So these are her words. She wrote them last night. For more than a year, I felt like maybe God had turned away from me. Psalm 102 felt like it was written for me, where the psalmist says, hear my prayer, Lord. Let me cry for help. Let my cry for help come to you. Do not hide your face from me when I am in distress. Turn your ear to me when I call. Answer me quickly. Answer me quickly. But he just didn't. And then one Sunday, we drove from Abilene to church in San Angelo, where I was working. And it was a completely average day. I felt the strain of driving an hour and a half to church with a toddler in tow. I was tired. I was spiritually tired. I was physically tired, emotionally tired. And the church had an attended nursery and a children's worship program, so I was grateful for some peace and some space to focus my attention. And we were singing. I can't remember which song. Suddenly, a chill ran through me. I had goosebumps, and a sense of awe swept over me as my heart raced. I am absolutely certain that God revealed his presence to me tangibly in that moment. I felt as though I was being wrapped in his peace. It's a moment I will treasure for the rest of my life, a distinct and clear memory of God showing himself to me. God showing up. It wasn't anything more than that, and it wasn't anything less than that. So a week later, Jesus' disciples are on the house again, and Thomas is with them, and again the doors are locked, again they're scared, and again Jesus comes, and he stands among them, and to a bunch of scared and confused people, he says, peace be with you. And then he turns to Thomas, and he says, put your finger here. See my hands. Reach out your hand and put it in my side. Stop doubting and believe. And maybe we hear this as an admonition. I don't think it is. I think that this is an invitation, a grace-filled, compassionate invitation for Thomas to find his own healing in the wounds of Jesus. By his wounds we are healed, Isaiah writes. We don't know whether Thomas actually touches Jesus. The text doesn't say. Thomas's response, though, is very clear. He responds with, my Lord and my God. The risen Jesus is truly our King, to whom Thomas then submits his whole life to serving. This Jesus, who is risen from the dead, is the Son of God, the one through whom all things were created, and who alone can redeem us back to the family of God. And we know that this moment here is the moment that Thomas decides to spend his entire life sharing his story, preaching Christ, talking probably about this moment, and enabling faith to those who have doubts. And Jesus tells him, because you have seen me, you believe. And then Jesus does something that we don't actually see a lot happening in the Bible. Jesus turns his attention to you. And he speaks directly to you and to me. He says, for those who have not seen, that's us, right? That's, I'm going to guess that that's us. To those who have not seen and yet have believed, Jesus has this to say. Bless you. As is often the case in Scripture, the story of Thomas speaks to me in a million ways. It speaks to you in a million ways. I'm just going to highlight three. One, there is acknowledgement. Doubt is a part of everyone's faith journey. Questions are a part of all of our lives. And it begins with the very first apostles. Our struggle to understand and the questions we may be wrestling with in no way disqualify us from our standing as disciples of Jesus. And no writing testifies to the experience of doubt more than the Bible itself. We see it in Thomas as his world collapses. We see it in Job, whose world collapses and he gets angry about it. We see it in the Psalms all over the place. Doubt is a part of the Christian faith. Two, there's compassion. Jesus has every right to cast Thomas aside as faithless. He rejected him. I'm not going to believe. But instead, Jesus appears and he kindly responds to Thomas's skeptical remarks by inviting them to come and see and touch and experience. And I don't think it's an accident that the first thing that Jesus says when he sees Thomas is first, peace be with you. And secondly, that thing that you said you needed, I'm going to immediately address that. Come, see, touch, feel. And third, blessing. No one here has had the experience that Thomas and the disciples did. We have not seen the resurrected Lord. Instead, we rely on the experiences of those who have. And so for those of us who are striving to follow Jesus, and yet we have questions, and yet we're not always sure how the pieces fit together, or we're struggling to experience the presence of God and with it the absolute assurance of God's love and faithfulness, and yet we're striving. Bless you. Bless you. Jesus says, blessed are you. We're going to worship our Lord. And as we do, we have this rhythm where we invite folks, if there's any way that they want to respond, they can. We'll pray together. We'll baptize you together. Anything that you need. Now's the time where we're going to do that during this song. So let's stand and worship our resurrected Lord.